Today is November the 8th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King, and he's on remote with me tonight. Podcasts of this program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and our website is pcradioshow.org. And we want to do a follow-up from last week's show. Joe, are you there?
I certainly am, Hank, and I'm anxious to hear your response to that follow-up.
Well, we were talking about iOS and that we feel that there's a vulnerability there that we have to talk a little bit more about and explain in greater detail, and that's the fact that your camera can be turned on along with your microphone without you even knowing about it. Joe,
last week when you started to mention this, I was shocked and I was upset, and I started doing some research, and I found that your favorite bugaboo, the ignorant or bad headline writer, was at work once again. This is not a vulnerability. This is not an exploit. This is a feature.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Okay.
Let me explain why I
say that. Go ahead. Explain it, Lou. Go ahead.
The iOS allows you to write a program or an app or whatever you wish, allows you to write a program that at a very low level will, if you give it specific permission, be able to activate and use the microphone, the camera, the video. That's a feature of the operating system. It's not a bug. That's the way it works. Now, what the headline writer is objecting to is that once you give a program, an app, or whatever, permission to access the camera, it continues to have that permission. You, as a program writer or as a user, have to be aware that the program or app has your permission to use the camera. That's not a bug. That's a feature.
Well, yes and no, Joe, because I could tell you that there's a very famous application and that's called Facebook, and I know that they are constantly sending me messages. Please upload a picture of yourself. We don't have it. And I just don't bother to do it, but if I happen to have an iPhone, I uploaded a picture of myself, I turn on the camera, and if I walk away, what happens?
If you run a different program or if you close the window that Facebook has, then nothing happens. It goes away. If, however, you keep running the Facebook program, then at any time while you're using the program that you want to upload a picture or take a picture or what have you, you can.
You know what? When it comes to Facebook, a lot of young people spend a lot of time on it.
I don't care if they spend 24/7 or 7/24 or whatever on it. Nothing bad is going to happen. But that's Facebook. Now, the question becomes, if you put up another program and, excuse me, from the Google Play Store or from the Apple App Store, and you give that program permission, if that program somehow is a piece of malware, and I know that the App Store and the Google Play Store both try very hard to keep any malware out of their system, but if somehow a piece of malware gets in there, and you give that malware permission to use the camera, then while that program is in the foreground, and only while it's in the foreground, it has the ability to use the camera without any without any particular knowledge being given to you. In other words, it can use it without turning on a light, without using an LED. And not only can it use it, but it can take a picture or record a voice and upload it without your knowledge because you've already given it permission to do that. You may have forgotten that you gave it, but you gave it the permission. That's why I say it's not an exploit or a piece of malware itself. That's a feature of the operating system. Now, where it's the headline was very, very scary, stop and think about it. A, you have to have a program that has the capability of taking a picture and upload it. B, you have to have given that program permission to take a picture and upload it. And C, that program has to be in the foreground, not while you're looking at anything else. It has to be in the foreground for it to work. Is that as bad as you thought it might be, Hank?
No, it's not as bad, but I still feel it's bad. I mean, it's not something that I think that what they should do is have a default of off, when a certain amount of time has...
Hey, the operating system has a default of off. That's there.
No. But when it's turned on, just like when I turn on my cell phone, if I don't do anything with it, it goes off within seconds.
And if basically the same thing happens here. It's not within seconds. I don't know where you have your thing set up to go to sleep or go to hibernate, but once it's gone to sleep or hibernate, the camera can't be used, the microphone can't be used. The program has to be in the foreground.
But by the way, Joe, I think
I agree with you, incidentally, that it would be much better if it wasn't, because this is opening it up to a piece of what we call social engineering.
Okay, that I agree with. In other words, what's going to happen is that with social engineering, you're going to always find people that will take advantage of it with a new way of doing something. It's always
the one
always happens.
That makes me feel a little bit better about it. Mm-hmm. Is this, even though this feature has been well known for several years, I think 4 years now, there's never been something found in the wild that takes advantage of it.
Well, the other thing that was reported on last week, and I know that we have lots of comments on, is with Google, and that they had problems last week. You want to comment on that?
Oh, I certainly do.
Just like turning you on, right?
Well, for about... Well, actually, it goes back to the days of Ross Greenberg when he invented a program that ran under Windows 95, which he called RAMNet. And what he was doing is he was allowing all of the people who used RAMNet, basically he only gave it to his friends, but all the people who used RAMNet could use somebody else on RAMNet to store their material, which in essence was a cloud. In other words, mm-hmm. If I was on RAMNet, I could store my program or my letter or whatever in the cloud.
Share files.
Yes. Okay. And the cloud might be in his studio or in your studio or in my studio.
Classic example is you use Dropbox with the Google browser to share files.
Exactly. And it's a terrific, wonderful thing, except my rule of thumb that I've been saying ever since we're on the radio is only store things that you have no problem with if they were published in your church or your synagogue newspaper and everybody could read them, because there is no privacy, no security. Well, I changed that. It has security if you've gone to the trouble of using your own encryption, not their encryption.
Well, Joe, I think for clarification, what you're talking about is that what happened last week was that some of the people found they got locked out because it turns out that Google is scanning the material, and there are certain key words or graphics that they, if they recognize it, they block it out. And that's so like you don't know about it, and you're wondering, well, how come you got locked out?
Right, and we don't know what those graphics or words or sentences are. Google has not published that information. It simply has, and now it's promising to change it, at least on Gmail. They're going to stop doing it sometime this year or next year. I'm not sure what their date is. They haven't really been clear on that. And stuff that goes into the cloud on the Google Docs, which is what this was, will continue to be scanned. But the reason people were locked out, they say, was because of an error in programming.
Yeah, an error in programming, yeah.
The error in programming was, Hank.
No. Come on. If you're looking for certain keywords, that's not programming. It's what words you pick to look at.
That's right. And the error in the programming was letting us know that they're doing this.
Yes.
That's what the error was. Now, again, you're perfectly safe if all you were storing was birthday greetings to your great-grandmother or things like that. But if you were thinking that anything you stored up there was as safe as if you stored it on a hard drive in your office, forget it. Mm. What you're saying is, when you use the cloud, is I completely trust the people at Google. I think they're wonderful. They can have all of my secrets. They can have my bank account numbers and my credit card numbers, because I know they'll never do anything wrong, nor will they ever allow anybody to hack into their database, nor will they allow, they themselves will break the law by not allowing the government access to those numbers.
One of the things that we like to have everyone be aware of is that we're not just talking about Google Gmail. It's anything that's Google. It's it's a Google Docs, Google. In other words, anything that's Google, they do a scan on the content.
It was particularly Google Docs in this case. We knew from previously that they did this to Google Gmail, and now we know that it's anything that Google has its greasy little hands on, they read. Now, you can call it scan, and you can call it whatever you want, but basically, it's read. It may be read by a machine, or it may be read by an editor, or it may be read by a hacker. That we don't know. We just know that it's not private.
Well, let me take a contrarian viewpoint, like you sometimes on this, all right?
I'm contrarian.
Suppose you have terrorists that are communicating with each other. Wouldn't you want this feature so that we could be alerted that they're doing something evil?
The answer to that is very simple. If you do not want freedom of speech and freedom of privacy and freedom of religion, all you have to do is, convince your representatives in Congress to do away with the Constitution. That's very simple, and if that's what you want, fine, I have no problem with it. But you have to know that that's what you're giving up. People can't take it away from you without telling you. And particularly, private companies can't do it. It's bad enough when the government does it.
Let me ask you, I know that you read a book many years ago, 1984. You probably said, this will never happen, right?
As a matter of fact, I said, as about many things that particular author wrote, Down and Out in London and Paris, he wrote about the Catalonian War, homage to Catalonia. He had a great deal of foresight, and he knew something, and he wanted to get the word out that while people might be basically good, there's a lot of them who have an inherent ability to do evil. And that's the truth. And if you don't think it's the truth, then don't read the Christian Bible, don't read the Hebrew Bible, because those books state very clearly that people have the ability to do evil.
Well, there's one other topic I do want to talk about, and that's an announcement by Microsoft, and it seems like a very simple announcement, but I've done a little thought about it, and I want to share with everyone. They've announced that by the end of the year, December the 31st of 2017, free upgrades for Windows 7, 8, and 8.1 will cease.
Hank, free upgrades to 10.
To 10 from Windows 7, 8, and 8.1 to 10 will no longer be available.
Now, up till now, they've been very proud of the fact that anybody could upgrade to Windows 10 at no charge. And you're telling me they're taking that away?
Well, I thought about it, and I said to myself, well, there is a loophole, and I'll explain what that loophole is. And I said that they can't close that loophole, and I'll tell you why. And that's a fact that could I talk about it? Would I be violating any ethics? And I said, well, if it's there, I should talk about it, right?
If it's public information, yes.
Well,
if you signed an NDA, no.
Well, one of the things is that if you were to buy a new machine, let's say a year ago or maybe a year and a half ago, and Windows 10 was on it, okay? And that would be, of course, it was released in November of 2015. And so that's about a year. It's almost 2 years ago. And it comes with Windows 10, and your system crashes. And you have a hidden partition, and that hidden partition is a form of distribution of the Windows operating system. And you do a factory reset because you said, look, I want to bring it back up. For whatever reasons are, it crashed. You bring it back up, and you come up with the Windows operating system that was originally on, which is the original one called Build 1511. Now we're into 1607. 1709 or something like that. So we've had a number of revisions on it, and you could recover. And
wait a minute. Didn't you once tell me that the hidden partition does not contain the full Windows 10?
Well, that's what I'm getting to, okay? Now, let's take a different example, okay? At the end of 2015, or let's say in the summer of 2015, you bought a brand new machine and it had Windows 7 on it, and you went through the upgrade to Windows 10, and your system crashes, and when you say, okay, let me go to the hidden partition and restore the operating system, you come up with Windows 7. Now, when you come up with Windows 7, wait a minute. I upgraded to Windows 10, and if you're saying by the end of the year, if I had to do a restoration, factory reset, how do I get back to it? So I said to myself, what they're probably saying is that the ISO file or the distributions of the of Windows 10, which is 1511, 1603, 1609, 1703, and so on, or can be used to upgrade, and you could do that today. In other words, it doesn't matter which version it is, you can upgrade Windows 7, 8, or 8.1 to 10 with any of those versions. Now,
but
those versions you can download from Microsoft. They are available for download today, and if you go to Media Creation, well, you know what? I'll put it on our website where you
Question.
Can go to get the files.
Yes. Be able to download those files after the end of the year?
That's what I'm saying, is that what they're going to do is they're going to probably pull those files off the Internet. So
they're saying to me, if I have Windows 8.1, I have it for maybe a year, year and a quarter, and it crashes. And if it crashes after December 31st, how am I going to rebuild it?
I'm saying before December 31st, you download Windows 10. You could download Windows 10, the ISO file, or the entire operating system. By the way, the ISO means it's the entire object binary file of the operating system. Download
it. If I go to Microsoft and I just say I want to upgrade the free upgrade to 10 after December 31st, that their index is not going to point me to any place.
That's right. Now, what I'm also saying is that because I've tried in both cases, okay, after you downloaded the ISO file, you could then do an upgrade of 7, let's say, or 8 or 8.1 to Windows 10. And there's two ways of doing it. One is you could upgrade to Windows 10 online with the updates where you have to be connected to the Internet. Or you could say, you know what, I'll take the upgrades later. You don't go online. My recommendation is when it's after the end of the year, you want to recover, you do not upgrade online, because if you do it online, they could easily say, aha, stop, do not go past go.
Okay, so, but how do I do it the other way?
Very simple. That you download it and you disconnect the adapter to not go onto the Internet, and you just do the upgrade. And that doesn't matter what version you have. It doesn't matter what version you have. It's an old version. It will do an automatic upgrade after you've gone to 10.
You have now totally confused me. I'm sitting here with my 8.1 or my 7 machine.
You have 7.
I have 7.
Yeah.
What's my next step? Just give it to me one step at a time.
Actually, you have two paths, and I know the one you're going to take, okay? The simple one is for anyone like Joe, do you have a Windows 7 still there? I will make the information available how you can go about downloading the ISO file or the Windows 10 latest copy of the distribution and save it. And then on the save file, you can use that to upgrade at a later date, but do it offline. In other words, offline meaning do the upgrade where you're not connected online to the internet.
And where do I go to find this ISO file?
Instead of giving you // and all that, I'll put it up on the internet and I'll try to find some keywords that I'll mention next week on how you can find it. Okay.
And we'll also ask Michael to put it up on our website once Hank decides on what the exact text.
The scenario I'm giving you is what I think is going to happen, because if you happen to have a machine that you bought 2 years ago and you went from 7 to 10 and you got to restore it, how do you restore it if they pull it off? So if you have not done it yet, definitely download the upgrade. Now, some people...
Now, Hank, you said one thing to me last week when we were talking about this, and you said, all right, download the upgrade, restore your machine, but before you do anything else, make an image of your drive.
Yes, but now, when you make an image of your drive, it includes all the initialization. If you download it, you have a pure copy. That means you could put it on any machine, okay?
So, all right, Joe? They've downloaded a copy you keep separately, and when you're ready to upgrade it, you disconnect yourself from the internet. You unplug your machine from the internet, and then using your CD drive or your DVD drive, you then do your upload.
Right.
Upgrade.
Okay. Joe, you know what? Before we run out of time, there's one more news item I want to get to, okay?
Go ahead. And
that's the fact that the CPU, or what we call the central processing unit chip, has evolved where it's more than just a CPU. Now it includes memory management, I/O ports, and basic communications, and they've all been folded into what we today call the CPU. Now, there's a graphics processing unit, or what we call GPU, that has been designed that offloads the graphics processing separate from the regular CPU work or the regular work that's done. But things are changing. There's a convergence of the two processing units, and although they're operating alongside each other, they're going to be all on the same die mount. So let's get to the topic of the convergence by Intel of the central processing unit with the graphics processing unit. But first, what is a graphics processing unit? You've heard the term CPU, which stands for central processing unit. It is the computer component that's responsible for interpreting and executing most of the commands from the computer's other hardware and software. But what is a GPU? GPU, or graphics processing unit, is a programmable logic chip processor specialized for display functions. The GPU renders images, animations, and video for the computer's screen. GPUs are designed with one goal in mind: process graphics really fast. Since this is the only concern they have, there have been some specialized optimizations in place that allow for certain calculations to go a lot faster than they would in a traditional processor. Your standard CPU has to do a lot more different calculations and processing that graphic processors do, so they can't be optimized in a similar manner. In a personal computer, a GPU can be present on a video card, or it can be embedded on the motherboard. Technically, the graphic card contains one or more GPUs as opposed to the CPU itself. Many associate the GPU as a computer thing, with high-end graphics cards being the integral part of gaming CPUs and high-power workstations. However, mobile devices like your smartphone also contains a GPU as part of the chipset, or one used just as often as a desktop-grade GPU.
Odds are there's a GPU in your tablet or smartphone right now. A good GPU can usually be identified as having large memory bus, 64-bit or higher, and high memory clock speed. This, combined with a number of cores and units for rendering geometry and textures, means you have a more powerful GPU. What is integrated graphics? Placing the computer display circuitry in the chipset on the motherboard or on the same chip on the CPU. Integrated graphics shares memory with the CPU and provides a more economical alternative to the standalone card, known as discrete graphics or dedicated graphics. An integrated graphics processing unit doesn't use its own RAM or memory. It utilizes the system's memory instead. So if you have a computer with 4 gigs of RAM, the video card can use anywhere between 1 to 5% of the available memory for graphics processing. Of course, this will slow down the CPU. This percentage varies depending on the size of the task. The benefit to an integrated unit is that it is cheaper, and an integrated graphics card also generates much less heat than a dedicated video card, and it uses drastically less power, which improves the overall battery life. Integrated graphics are perfect for people doing everyday graphics processing. A dedicated or discrete GPU has its own independent source of video memory, leaving the RAM in your system untouched. Dedicated cards are perfect if you are also a serious gamer or professional graphics designer. There are a few drawbacks. These video cards do get warm. If you are a serious gamer, the GPU will have to work harder and it will heat up quickly. These cards are also power hungry, so using a laptop with a dedicated graphics card will decrease the battery life. GPU can be present on a video card, or it can be embedded on the motherboard, and now, with Intel and AMD, the GPU is on the CPU die, freeing up space on the motherboard for other circuitry processing. The new chip will be part of the 8th generation Core H series of processors, and comes with discrete level graphics cards built in, as well as its own RAM. Having all this built into the processor frees up space for other components inside a laptop, so device manufacturers can squeeze in things like larger batteries or more optimal fan designs. Specifically, the new processor incorporates 3 typically distinct components to coexist on a single chip. The company also came up with power sharing framework that lets the GPU manage each component's temperature, performance, and energy use. This infrastructure should free up about 3 square inches of board space that could either be used for other components as described above, or make for thinner laptops altogether, or even a thinner smartphone. The idea is that powerful laptops for gamers no longer be chunky and big in size. New Core H processor will be released in the first quarter of 2018, and many laptop makers are expected to offer products powered by the chip. With a CPU and GPU on a single die, what do we now call this hybrid chip?
For the second half hour, we have the following feature segments. Dr. Alfred Poor, with his wearable and health technology, will be covering retina scan may detect Alzheimer before symptoms appear, followed by silicon rubber used to create flexible supercapacitor using a 3D printer, and he will also cover states that are changing their laws to support the use of telehealth technology. I will be doing a segment on Black Friday, caveat emptor, and Marty Winston, well, he's going to play with a rhyme, heir apparent and peer apparent.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider.
One of the sad truths of aging is that you become more susceptible to diseases like Alzheimer's disease, which is a debilitating neurological disease that attacks the brain, leads to severe mental impairment, and eventually death. It's caused by the buildup of toxic protein plaque, little nodules of deposits of these proteins inside the brain, which interferes with the brain's normal activity. it's a huge problem. People have impaired cognitive function, but physically can live for many, many years. And right now, according to the Alzheimer's Association, there are more than 5 million people in the U.S. that are suffering from Alzheimer's. They project that the number of Alzheimer's patients could grow to more than 16 million by 2050. So it's a big problem, and it's not going away anytime soon. One of the big problems with Alzheimer's is detecting and diagnosing it. In general, you have to wait until the symptoms appear, and then they use brain scans or analyzing fluid from the brain in order to make a firm diagnosis about the disease. Well, a bunch of researchers at Cedars-Sinai have come up with a way that they think may be able to identify Alzheimer's disease before the symptoms even begin to show. They've discovered that a high-resolution scan of a patient's retina, the nerve lining at the back of the eyeball, can reveal the same kind of protein deposits as happens in the brain, but these protein deposits can be detected in the retina non-invasively just by taking a high-resolution image of the retina itself. If this turns out to be an effective and reliable way of detecting Alzheimer's, it will also help doctors track the progress of the disease. And if it can be determined that you have the disease before the symptoms show up, it may make it possible to have earlier intervention with more effective treatments to help slow down the onset of the disease. And it also will give patients and their families more time to get their affairs in order and prepare for the cognitive impairment that is going to follow. So we'll have to see whether or not this turns out to be a useful diagnostic tool. But if it is, it could help make life a lot clearer and give people early warning about this disease that causes such trouble. Digital wearable technology is creating a total revolution in so many different aspects of our lives, not the least of which is the health tech area. But these devices need power. And there's all kinds of ways that we can harvest energy from motion and heat and light and so forth. But we still need to store that energy that can then be used by wearable devices. The problem is that standard battery technology is rigid and heavy and thick and, you know, won't bend. So it's really not very suitable for applications with the human body. We need something that's flexible and lightweight and that you can set and forget. Well, a bunch of researchers at the Brunel University in London have developed a flexible battery-type device that could solve a lot of problems. It's actually what's called a supercapacitor. Supercaps are different from batteries in that they can be charged much, much faster, and they can be discharged much faster than a standard battery. Also, they tend to have a much longer lifetime, that they can be charged and discharged many, many more times without aging the way a typical battery does. Well, this group in London have actually developed a way to print one of these supercaps using a 3D printer. And what they do is use the printer to lay down alternating layers, first of silicone rubber and a conductive layer, and then a gel electrolyte that goes in between, and then another conductive layer, and so forth. These layers are built up like a layer cake and can be formed into a very flexible, easy device that looks like a standard wristband. The fact that they can be printed quickly and at very low cost with a standard 3D printer would mean that production costs should be very small. These supercap wristbands could be incorporated into clothing or other areas of the body, or you could have a flexible device there, and it could store energy produced by energy harvesting, and it could also power wearable devices of all sorts. This is a new development that hopefully will make it easier to power wearable devices that will find even new ways to change our lives. One of the wonderful things about wearable technology for health and medical applications is that they can generate clinical quality data that doctors can use to diagnose disease and track and monitor a patient's progress with different diseases and conditions. One of the problems is that you still, in many cases, have to go to the doctor to find out what the information means. In fact, in many cases, until recently, it's actually been illegal for a doctor to diagnose or treat a patient who wasn't in the same room with them. As it turns out, the regulation of medical practices and stuff, for the most part, is handled at the state level. So each state has its own licensing requirements and its own rules and laws and regulations that physicians have to comply with. One of the advantages of this digital technology is that we can do telehealth, telemedicine, where the doctors and patients communicate through phone or video chat and exchange information. It's much more convenient. It means that the patient doesn't have to spend all that time traveling to and from the doctor's office and sitting around the waiting room. It's more efficient for the doctor because they can see patients quickly and spend time with them talking over the video chat connection and getting all their information in front of them, so it's easy to work with. So the whole thing can be a whole lot more efficient and effective. The only problem is we need to get the state legislators to get on board with it. Well, the good news is that this is happening. States are modifying their laws rapidly to adapt to the new technologies available for telehealth and telemedicine. For example, in the area of mental health, there's been a survey of telemental and telebehavioral health services that are available in different states. Many states are making big changes to their laws. For example, in the past year, Arkansas, Hawaii, Indiana, Louisiana, and Maine all enacted new regulations that allow physician-patient relationships over audio or visual telehealth connections. And 31 states and the District of Columbia are now supporting private payer arrangements for telehealth services. And even the Department of Veterans Affairs is getting on board. They have proposed the idea of allowing medical services to VA patients. And the big change here is they want to be able to provide those services across state lines, which would mean that the physician no longer has to be in the same state as the patient. This could open up things, make it much more flexible to provide a range of different services and be much more convenient for the VA patient so they don't have to travel to specific VA hospitals or centers, and it could make the whole process much more efficient. There are already 22 states that have agreed to expedite licensing for doctors in multiple states. So it could well be that in the future you're going to be able to pick and choose your doctor from anywhere in the country and be able to see them pretty much anytime you want, just as simple as the opening up the video chat window. It's great to see the state legislatures moving to make this new technology and new way of treatment possible.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Technically, Black Friday falls on November the 24th of this year, but retailers already have begun to promote the huge discounts they plan to offer, and some deals already are available to shoppers. Black Friday sales are no longer limited to brick-and-mortar stores. For example, Amazon kicked off Black Friday deals last week and will offer free shipping on more than 100 million items. Not to be outdone, Walmart announced huge savings on products in various departments. It also unveiled a number of special programs, including early access, pre-Black Friday, online specials, and Black Friday and Christmas ad match. It has a data compare section on its website. Sears and Kmart, which are under the same ownership, have decided to discount everything in the store. Sears reported will mark down goods 10 to 50% and Kmart 10 to 40%. Kmart also has decided to bring back its blue light specials, while Sears has revived its holiday catalog. Other people like eBay and Costco are promoting product discounts that extend to a wide variety of categories. Dell last week announced Black Friday and Cyber Monday deals, including up to 50% off on a variety of Dell PCs. You may have noted that last year I bought a Dell 11.2-inch notebook that normally sells for $200 for under $100. The unit, by the way, is still in current production. Black Friday has morphed into a one-day in-store event to an all-encompassing holiday. Black Friday was traditionally the time when retailers went from being in the red to being in the black. That is the origin of the term Black Friday. Black Friday has begun to lose its meaning, however,
and retailers now extend Black Friday savings to a longer period of time and leveraging Cyber Monday for huge sales. Up to one-third of all store sales occur in the fourth quarter. Sales are actually offered on various items year-round, but the holiday sales label is only applied in late October or early November. It is expected that this year's Black Friday spending will grow from an average of $495 to $737 per person, or about 49%. Let's face it, though, how real are the big discounts? While they may indeed represent markdowns from an item's original price, in many cases, these original or list price items are fake. They're inflated to make the inevitable discounts seem more impressive. It's not like they were offering everything at full price one day, and then they slashed the price across the board the next. A better gauge of true discounts on Black Friday and Cyber Monday then would be a comparison of prices for the same item in the days before Thanksgiving. This is essentially what the retail solutions firm Boomerang Commerce just did with a select group of stores known for competitive prices. After gathering prices for 1,000 popular items, the gist of Boomerang's research can be summed up as follows. Black Friday and Cyber Monday prices were nothing special at all. Retailers did not significantly discount the vast majority of popular products. Of course, there were some phenomenal doorbusters deals featuring remarkably cheap prices over the past weekend, but by and large, these deals were the exception. It was far more likely that prices for popular products dip only slightly or remain pretty much the same over 10 or so days culminating in Cyber Monday. For example, for Amazon, Boomerang Commerce estimates that the average discount across prices were 2.5% or less for the entire shopping period. Walmart average discount was 3.6% or less, while Target showed the deepest discount and average of price across items was 6.8% or less from the day before Thanksgiving through the day after Black Friday. Bear in mind, though, this does not mean that Target necessarily has the best prices. It could have been very well have the biggest discounts if it had the highest prices to begin with. Caveat emptor.
I know some of you are wondering, this guy's always talking about the 40-year house project. 40yearhouse.com describes the project all over the place. And I'm all over the place talking about a lot of different stuff that comes out of the planning and the decisions and the execution and all of that. Is there no end? Is it all tangents? Does any of it relate? Well, I don't know. We'll find out when it's done. But there are two subjects that I've decided I'd address this week, and they kind of sound alike, but they're different subjects. One is heir apparent. That's not H-E-I-R heir, that's A-I-R, heir apparent, and the other is pair apparent. So first things first. Your workbench has, what, screwdrivers and drills and maybe if you're lucky, a great soldering station and oscilloscopes and meters, that kind of thing. We think of our technical work as being primarily electronic, sometimes mechanical, now and then chemical. We tend not to think of it as being pneumatic, but the need for air is there. Blowers, best way to keep computers and keyboards clean and to open up their breathing passages, their ventilation. Heat is a huge detriment to computer reliability and longevity, true for many electronics. The more it's got heat, the more it's likely to fail earlier. Vacuums also have a role. You know, it's not just the blowers we use to blow those clean. Vacuums are good at corralling the dust bunnies before they get into that gear, not to mention creating a workspace that's at least a little less old and gray than we feel. We also like vacuum tools. One that came in recently is a Dremel that fits on a shop vacuum. It works there as an attachment. No electricity. The vacuum makes the tool head spin. So if you're using that to cut the hole in the plasterboard to put in a switch or an outlet, that ugly white powder doesn't even hit the floor. It goes into the vacuum directly. That's brilliant. That is such a time saver. We also have a desoldering pencil. And it, too, has the vacuum in it, but it's not created by a vacuum. It's created by a Venturi, a little spinning thing inside the controller that is powered by an air compressor. Sometimes air compressors in some environments are called shop air, and that's fine. It could be shop air. The idea is by spinning the Venturi creates a vacuum. The vacuum goes down the center of the desoldering pencil, and the liquid solder, once you heat it up, goes up the pencil, and it's gone from your work. It's just, oh, isn't that amazing? So compressors, blowers, vacuums, it's the air that isn't always necessarily apparent as part of our work, but air is apparently part of our work. Now, let's transition from the air apparent to the pair apparent. In this case, some of the pairs are not so apparent. We're using all wired connections in building our cybernetic house. We won't use batteries. We'll provide our own DC buses, which means, you know, we're busing ground, 0 volts, and 3.3, and 5, and 12, and running those everywhere and using cabling for it. There's other wiring that has to connect to the Raspberry Pis that are distributed all the place that those things are powering. For example, light switches are not directly controlling power. They're inputs to the Raspberry Pi, so the control system then can control the lights. The magnetic read switch that tells us whether doors are open or closed. Other sensors can be, in some cases, single wires if they're powered and they're using a ground connection from the power bus, because we make sure ground is ground is ground throughout the house. So sometimes a single wire will do it, but we don't want to confuse us. We want to choose a non-standard color for that wire. Most of the things that we have to reach need pairs, and it's really tough finding paired wires that are not black-white or black-red. Speaker wires sometimes are clear-clear, one with a rib. Two-wire power cables, zip cord as it's called, the things that have been around since at least the 40s that are used to connect to a plug that connects to gear like radios and phonos back in the day, lamps these days. We've made a point of not using those for our signal runs, although they're very, very commonplace in speaker runs. Other two-conductor cables are just not, it wouldn't be nice to have yellow and violet as a pair. Special order, can't get it easily, and it's going to cost a lot more. Even white and blue is hard to get. We're doing a little trick that I wanted to share with you. We're getting larger quantities of two wire in a standard color. Red and black is easiest. White and black, if we can find it, haven't made that purchase yet. Red and black would be fine. And what we're doing is getting it in a white jacket or a very light gray jacket, because then we can take the length of wire that we want to run to a purpose, grab some spray paint, and color code the jacket in a color that's not being used elsewhere in the house. It gets to be important later. As you're up in the attic or down in the crawl space looking at the wiring going hither and yon, knowing on eyesight what the next pair is. It could be anything. It could be a garage remote control. It could be a thermostat wire. It could be a speaker wire, an intercom wire, a doorbell wire. It's no telling what it is without some sense of identification. And color is the easiest one. Even in a flashlight, colors will stand out. Now, you certainly need a key for that, and we'll use some trick, probably lamination, to create keys and distribute them around the house so 40 years from now they'll be legible. It's also really kind of unfortunate that we have to run a lot of wires in a few places. One of those places is in the garage ceiling, where we have a light that blinks to tell you when you've pulled in far enough and you should park the car, and five overhead, in each garage space, five overhead ultrasonic sensors, each of which is a four-pin connection. One of those pins is power, and we can get that from our power bus. One of those pins is ground, and we can get that from our power bus. Two of the pins are signal. Now, the way we have it set up, a Raspberry Pi, one Raspberry Pi per row, can pull those in turn. So you pull one, get a distance, pull the second one, get a distance. And what they're doing is measuring the distance from their position on the ceiling to whatever's in their path, the top of a car, the trunk of a car, the floor, or maybe, if it's open, the garage door. That would be the first thing in the path. So by taking those distances, we can easily determine whether the garage door is open or closed, whether the space is empty or there's a car in it, whether the car is pulled all the way in, whether the car is pulled in a little too far. Those are all easy. And we can also add LIDAR on the far wall to determine the distance to whatever that obstacle is, hopefully the front of the car. Getting wired to those ultrasonic sensors could mean 20 wires up there, but no, because we're busing the power. So it doesn't mean 10 wires up there, and how can we tell those apart when those 10 connections come back to the Raspberry Pi? Look inside your computer. There's an answer there. It's called ribbon cable. We can get a length of ribbon cable, and we may only be using 2 per head, but that 10-wire-wide ribbon gives us a single thing to make all those connections in one place and uniquely identify them at both ends. And again, we can create a key. We have pairs, and we need to make each pair apparent. There you have it, heir apparent and pair apparent. And I might add, when you make those keys, like you do for data, like you do for power, like Hank always tells you, back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the Northeast Tri-State area. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its meeting on wireless security cameras Thursday, November the 9th at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401, and that's in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh User Group will be meeting Friday, November the 10th at 7 p.m. They meet at the New York Institute of Technology Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they'll meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherer Hall. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, November the 28th, 7 p.m. at Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on November the 30th, Thursday, at 6:45 p.m., and the presentation is Augmented Reality with Microsoft HoloLens. They'll be meeting at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their general meeting on Friday, December the 1st, at 8 p.m., and the presentation is Web Browser Shootout. They'll be meeting at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on Minecraft, Tuesday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. They'll meet at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on new tech toys, obviously just before Christmas, Tuesday, December the 5th, 1:30 p.m., Community Room at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, December the 7th at 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor, White Plains, New York. All these meetings are open to the public. There's no charge to attend, and you are all welcome to attend, and we hope to see you there. If you happen to have any computer meetings that I've missed, just notify me or send me a message at hank@pcradioshow.org and let me know the name of the club, presentation, time, and the meeting place. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, or on WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch, and keep on computing, and remember, back up, back up, and obviously, back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.